across the Middle East. They appear to be pulling back their imperialist aggression to what they consider their own backyard, Latin America. Apart from being socialist-inspired, Venezuela sits on the world's largest oil reserves. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Iran is stepping up its diplomatic efforts in Tunisia. The Iranian ambassador, Mir Masoud Husseinian, delivered a formal invitation from Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi following several high-level meetings, including talks with Tunisia's president and the foreign ministers of both nations. The letter invites Tunisian officials to visit Iran to exchange expertise and strengthen bilateral ties.
This invitation aims to enhance cooperation in political, cultural, and economic fields, building on the successful meetings our officials have had so far.
Iran's ambassador referred to the Tunisian president's previous meetings with Iran's foreign minister, describing them as a highly successful, noting that the discussions addressed key issues of mutual interest and were met with a positive reception.
President Kais Saied is well versed in Iranian laws, rights and culture, with knowledge spanning hundreds of years. He had previously met with the Iranian foreign minister, during which he demonstrated his understanding of issues important to the Iranian people. The meeting was very successful, and all matters were positively received.
Analysts say this rapprochement is strategic, reflecting Iran's growing regional influence and Tunisia's interest in strengthening ties with Tehran.
This rapprochement is no coincidence. It stems from Iran's rise as a regional power and Tunisia's willingness to engage on shared political, economic, and social issues, including support for Palestine.
Experts also emphasize that the diplomatic engagement is grounded in shared stances on regional conflicts and international politics.
On the political and international level, especially regarding the Palestinian cause and resistance against Israel, these shared principles guide the growing Tunisia-Iran relations.
Cultural exchange, joint expertise programs, and increased dialogue signal a new phase in bilateral relations. Both countries appear determined to build closer ties amid shifting regional dynamics. Iran is stepping up its outreach to Tunis, delivering a formal message from Foreign Minister Araghchi as both countries move closer diplomatically. The letter marks a new phase in their growing political alignment. Iskandar Nawar, Tunis.
On the slopes of Mount Hermon, Syrians and Palestinians rallied in Beit Jinn near the capital, denouncing repeated Israeli raids and offering condolences to the families shattered by the latest Israeli raid on the village.
They stormed our homes at dawn, terrorizing families with gunfire. We defended ourselves with what we had, inflicting casualties, but their warplanes destroyed entire homes with the residents inside. We appealed to the UN, the Arab nations, and the world, but no one responded.
Protesters marched through the village's narrow streets, condemning the attack that killed 13 people and wounded 25. They said their grief will only strengthen their resolve to remain on their land and stand with the families of the fallen.
I am the father of Mohammed Amin Ibrahim. We see martyrdom in defense of our land as source of pride and dignity. We fear no one but God. They attacked our homes and our dignity, but we stood our ground because we had to.
The village also celebrated the release of detainee Ali Qasim Hamad, arrested in late June. His return galvanized residents who renewed their rejection of normalization and reaffirmed their commitment to liberating every occupied Syrian and Palestinian territory.
We are here to reject normalization with the Zionists. Every inch of Syria belongs to Syrians, and the Zionist entity has no place here. One day, we will liberate all occupied lands from Syria to Palestine.
In Beit Jinn, grief has transformed into a collective vow of resilience. Locals say the attack may have claimed lives, but it has only strengthened their resolve to defend both their land and their future. Ali Muhammad, Damascus.
Despite heightened U.S. and Israeli pressures on Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance will not give up its only defensive capability. In a televised speech Friday, he emphasized that Hezbollah has no regard for U.S. and Israeli dictates.
We are cooperating with the government, which has taken the diplomatic route to end the aggression, and we are supporting it in its efforts. The U.S. and Israel have no business in dictating how we manage our internal affairs. Whatever we decide in Lebanon or what we do in Lebanon, whether on the issue of arms or other issues, does not concern them. The only framework which needs to be met in dealing with the Israeli enemy is the ceasefire agreement. We have complied, but Israel has not.
The Hezbollah chief said Israel's aggressions have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons. He said the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for the gradual occupation of Lebanon and push for its greater Israel project. Sheikh Qassem warned that if Lebanon concedes, the U.S.-Israeli conditions will not be limited to the issue of arms. Experts believe that while the U.S. and Israel are jointly working on one agenda, they might differ on the means.
One area where they might disagree is in terms of how far to go to eliminate Hezbollah. I think the Israelis would want to do that at all costs. I think for the Americans, at least for some people in the Trump administration, they realize that America has interests in Lebanon. By the way, they're building their biggest embassy in Lebanon. So would all-out chaos serve American interests? In the end, if you want to have a big embassy, if you want to be influential in Lebanon, I think you need stability.
The speech coincided with a visit of a delegation of the UN Security Council members who met with Lebanese leaders and stressed the significance of the implementation of UN resolutions. During the meeting, Lebanese President Joseph Aoun urged the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and withdraw from Lebanon. Experts believe UN resolutions are theoretically a framework for peace, while Israel has implemented none.
Basis for peace are these resolutions. They're supposed to be applied. For example, Resolution 242 calls for the withdrawal of the Israelis from the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights and Jerusalem, whereas the Israelis are expanding their occupation in the Golan Heights. They are occupying parts of South Lebanon. They occupy Gaza. They are trying to also do an ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. They continue to kidnap a large number of Lebanese in violation of the ceasefire agreement, which is part of the Resolution 1701.
When asked about how the UN can enforce an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, the Russian ambassador to the UN told Press TV that he hopes diplomatic efforts can bear fruit.
We can do whatever we can in the Council. But the Council doesn't have military means, of course.
During their meetings with Lebanese leaders, the UN delegation voiced support for stability in Lebanon. President Joseph Aoun stressed that Lebanon has always cooperated with the United Nations, but the main obstacle now, he said, was the Israeli occupation and aggression. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Students have begun returning to the shattered campuses of Gaza's universities, reopening notebox among collapsed lecture halls in another act of defiance against the near-total collapse of the territory's higher education system.
The Islamic University is back to schooling today, sending a strong message of hope and determination. During the genocidal war, the Israeli army has deliberately destroyed most of the university's buildings and facilities. However, for us and for our people, education is a priority despite all the challenges. Now we've managed to reopen engineering, sciences, and nursing sections.
The devastation is perhaps most evident at the Islamic University of Gaza, once the largest academic institution in the territory, where buildings have been reduced to rubble, laboratories destroyed, and libraries set ablaze.
We are back to school again. Despite the challenges and the crises unfolding in every aspect of life, despite the transportation crisis and the lack of possibilities, we insist to continue learning. It is their target to decimate our education systems, but we are here to challenge them.
The students have returned despite the challenges of lacking learning materials, electricity, and coming on foot from distant areas.
Today marks our first day back after 2 years of genocide. The university lies in ruins, yet we are eager to return and continue the educational journey we began. The challenges are immense, both for the institution and for us as students. We navigate destroyed roads with great difficulty from our displacement areas, but there is a sense of relief in finally reclaiming a normal life.
In the ruins of Gaza's shattered campuses, the act of learning has become an assertion of existence, an insistence that even amid wreckage, an educated future is still worth striving for. Adam Rahim for Gaza City, Palestine.
Thank you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a televised address to the Iranian people on September 23rd, 2025. As for the next matter, which is the third topic in the statements of political figures, the issue of negotiating with the U.S. is frequently raised. Well, there are differing views on this. As I have said, some consider it beneficial and necessary, some believe it's harmful, and others have more moderate opinions. Opinions vary. I wish to communicate to our dear nation what I have understood, seen, felt, and experienced over these many years. I also urge our political officials and those active in the political field to reflect on these words, to think about them, and to base their judgments on knowledge and information. My point is that under the present circumstances, now it's possible that in 20 or 30 years the situation may be different, but we aren't discussing that right now. In the current situation, first of all, negotiating with the U.S. government does nothing to serve our national interests. It will bring us no benefit, nor will it shield us from any harm. This is the first point. In other words, it's a fruitless endeavor. It has no benefit for the country, and it doesn't shield us from any harm. It definitely has no such effect. This is the first point. Second, on the contrary, there are also harms that are the result of such talks. That is to say, not only do they lack any benefit, but my second point is that negotiating with the U.S. in the current situation would bring great harm to the country. Some of this harm could perhaps be said to be irreparable. It would have this much harm, which I will now describe. The reason we say negotiations aren't to our benefit and have no advantage for us is because the U.S. side has previously specified the outcome of the negotiations in advance. It has declared that it will only accept negotiations, it wants to enter negotiations, where the outcome will be an end to nuclear activities and enrichment in Iran. This means we would sit at the negotiating table with the U.S., only for the result of our talks to be precisely what they've already decreed must be done. This isn't negotiations. It's dictating the outcome. It's imposition to sit and negotiate with a party when the result must necessarily be exactly what they want and demand. Is that negotiations? This is how the other side is talking now. They say, let's negotiate. And what they want from the negotiations is for Iran to not have uranium enrichment.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. Me from all the ways that were wrong.
KRIB English Radio.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. For decades, FIFA has hidden behind a cloak of neutrality. Keep politics out of football, they've said, while fining players for messages of solidarity and silencing protests for justice. But now, the mask has slipped. In a stunning act of hypocrisy, FIFA President Gianni Infantino has awarded his inaugural Peace Prize to Donald Trump, president of bombs, borders, and bigotry. The same organization that punishes a player for a slogan rewards a man who calls entire nations garbage, who fuels genocide, and whose legacy is one of global division. And the double standards don't stop there. While FIFA moved with lightning speed to ban Russia for what it considered the invasion of Ukraine, it has for years refused to even debate suspending Israel as it wages a documented genocide on Palestine. So what is FIFA's true game? Is it a guardian of sport or a political arm of American empire and its allies? In this Spotlight episode, we're not here to play games. We're here to expose them. But first, let's get more details in this report.
Players frequently face fines and bans from FIFA for expressing political messages, as the football governing body has long championed a policy of political neutrality. Yet on Friday, FIFA President Gianni Infantino awarded the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize to U.S. President Donald Trump. While presenting the prize, Infantino expressed support for Trump's international deals, including the so-called Abraham Accords that established formal ties between Israel and several Arab states without resolving the question of Palestinian statehood. Infantino has previously warned against using football to stoke division, saying that the political neutrality of sports should be protected. 2 years later, critics point out that he created a prize to celebrate peace and unity and then handed it to a president who called people from Somalia garbage just days prior and has advocated for increased military spending across the Western world. Trump also ordered the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities in June and continues to arm Israel despite the ongoing genocide against Palestinians. Trump's administration has also carried out airstrikes against vessels near Venezuela. At home, the U.S. president has intensified an anti-immigration crackdown that has led to the detention and attempted deportation of non-citizens. Some advocates have been targeted for their criticism of Israel. A group of international activists who campaigned for suspending Israel from the world football have released a statement calling the award to Trump a shameful development. They also accused FIFA and UEFA of double standards over their failure to act against Israel in the 2 years of its war on Gaza, while swiftly sanctioning Russia following the breakout of the war in Ukraine in 2022. Infantino has refused to take action against Israel, arguing that football cannot solve geopolitical issues. The apparent preferential treatment of Israel calls into question the integrity of FIFA's supposed commitment to political neutrality, as FIFA continues to tout football as a unifying force on the global stage. It must now confront mounting accusations of hypocrisy and double standards that threaten its credibility.
Well, today we are joined by Mr. Ashish Prashad, political analyst and former West Asia Peace Envoy Advisor from New York. And Ms. Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Well, let's go ahead and start off with our own coin toss, shall we? First of all, Ms. Hatoum, let's go ahead and start off with you. I mean, this Trump award. How can FIFA even claim this, quote, political neutrality is sacred, while creating a political prize and handing it to one of the most disruptive, narcissistic, ignorant and racist political figures on earth today? And just by the way, for our viewers, these are the exact terms and adjectives that Americans, his own people, describe him as.
I'm not surprised at all when it comes to this move by FIFA. At the end of the day, all of the international organizations are shooting themselves in the foot one after the other, exposing themselves, and the masks are off. FIFA is the most recent one only. I mean, if you had any doubt, the IAEA before it, the United Nations, you name it. Every single entity across the world that is headed by somebody who's appointed by one of the big five countries, then you have to think about it this way. They are at any point followers of one of those big five countries or all of them. And at the same time, they have to humor the Israeli occupation because the Zionist global lobby is very strong and it controls everybody, be it through the scandals they have on them or other secrets. When it comes to Infantino, whom we just basically naturalized as a Lebanese citizen because he's married to a Lebanese lady just recently, you have to understand one thing. This guy is, at the end of the day, a salesman, and he wants to actually, what you call, stay in power. The best way to do it is to have a network. So he's working as a marketing person. When it comes to Donald Trump, again, this person is the one who controls all the keys at the moment, a crazy person who controls the world. So at the end of the day, FIFA, which has so much bigotry against the countries that the Americans are enemies with, or the Israelis are enemies with, then that's basically where you see FIFA distancing itself or basically approaching. When it comes to Russia, they were really, really fast in suspending its team. When it comes to the Israeli entity, they don't see, they don't hear, they don't say anything. And when it comes to the Americans, they will always kiss the hands and feet of the Americans.
Well, definitely, Ms. Hatoum, we're going to be elaborating a bit on that specific point later in today's program. Mr. Prashad, I'd like to go ahead and move over to you. I mean, if a player took a knee against Trump's policies or even wore a shirt criticizing his immigration crackdown, they'd be fined. What message does this specific crowning of him with a Peace Prize actually send to its own players when FIFA's honoring a president who not only embodies these characteristics but also has even mocked some of their home countries, such as those from African nations?
Look, I mean, it's, you know, firstly, thank you for having me. This is a truly shameful development, but it's not a surprise. I mean, Gianni Infantino, for the entire year, has been used by this White House to normalize their atrocities. Remember that, right? The biggest way to normalize atrocities, the biggest way to normalize the behavior, bad, good, whatever, of a nation, of individuals, of people, is to participate in cultural items, right? We recently covered Eurovision. Obviously, football is the biggest sport in the world. And the White House has, you know, knowing that this World Cup was coming to the United States, has drawn in what my colleague Leila pointed out, a marketing guy who is nothing, wants the spotlight himself, frankly, as well. They've drawn in this individual to help them normalize the genocide in Gaza, to help them normalize this fake peace plan, to help them normalize any ceasefire, and normalize all the actions they've got taken forward. Look, many FIFA members, by the way, in South America, that, you know, one of the biggest regions for football, might be attacked by this president between now and the next World Cup. What is FIFA going to do about that? nothing. Because Gianni Infantino is aligning himself with this president and his political views just so he can share his spotlight. Now, you ask, what does it say to the people that, you know, people can't sit there, go down on one knee or protest the ICE raids that are going on? Look, this has been America from day one. Right, you and me know that. Like, it's just pigeoned differently, right? Whether it's Biden or Trump, foreign policy, domestic policy, they try to always separate culture from actual change because they know the power that culture can bring. That's why they crack down so hard. And I'll give you another example because people are going to go hard at Trump. President Obama, during the BLM uprisings in 2020, could have changed the course of the country when he wasn't in office. The NBA were looking to him to ask him for his permission to strike, for his permission that black people wouldn't work or be entertainment for the white population during the BLM thing. And he told them not to strike. Remember that. This is consistent from all American presidents when it comes down to it. Some will not crack down publicly, but they will privately shut down any cultural revolutionary spirits that athletes have, that countries have, that other individuals have.
Well, Mr. Prashar, I'd like to thank you for pointing that out to our viewers who continues to need to be reminded sometimes about what history has shown us, and we don't want to just focus on today. Ms. Hatoum, let me move over back to you, and let's, of course, bring in Israel, the double standards and the geopolitics. Now, again, this is something we always have to pop up in any discussion. FIFA statutes prohibits the membership for entities that are not independent. Given Israel's control over movement, the infrastructure, and even the lives of the Palestinian footballers, how can the Israel Football Association even be considered independent?
Well, they're not independent. I mean, if you actually want to implement international law, the Israeli entity itself is not a state. It's still an entity because it doesn't have fixed borders. So technically, under international law, it's not a state. It's not independent at any point. They are a force of occupation. The place or the region is still under basically multiple what you call frictions and back and forth when it comes to wars. So if they want to implement international law on one side and not on the other, that clearly shows their double standards. That's one. The other thing, not suspending their team is another double standard versus basically the Russians whom they suspended directly. So if I look at the whole situation, I see a very corrupt group, and this is not the first thing that actually catches my eye. I mean, if you remember, FIFA was marred by all these scandals when it comes to taking bribes from Qatar, from other countries, when it comes to voting to certain members or appointing certain members. And some of them actually stuck to its leadership and its members. So at the end of the day, when you have a corrupt bunch ruling one of the highest bodies when it comes to the most popular sport in the world, one of the most popular sports in the world, that tells you a lot of things. They can be bought, they can be actually threatened with scandals, and they will have to implement double standards based on who holds their cards.
Well, exactly. Mr. Prashar, I do want to come over to you. Ms. Leila Hatoum did mention something for the second time. She mentioned Russia. And just a reminder of you from something we had put in our report, that in 2022, just 3 years ago, FIFA instantly removed Russia from the competition. The principle was clear. A member committing a severe breach of international law cannot use football as a platform. Now, this is their own wordings. This is their own statement. Why does this principle not apply again to Israel? Infantino himself says, quote, football cannot solve geopolitical issues. But wasn't banning Russia precisely an attempt to respond to such a geopolitical issue? I mean, isn't that considered picking a side, basically?
Well, there's so many questions there. I want to answer them all individually. So firstly, actually, FIFA and UEFA are pretty consistent. They didn't want to ban Russia. I want to make sure everyone understands this. 12 European countries, and this is where geopolitics does cut into this, led by Sweden and Poland, on the second day of Russia's invasion, when there was no clear war crimes, when there was just an invasion at that point, they called UEFA and FIFA and said they would boycott football. Now, as you know, Europe is the biggest moneymaker of football. 12 European nations, and they guaranteed another 6 were going to join, would basically shut down the global game, in essence. And they forced UEFA and FIFA into position where they could make those statements, where they're saying, we're going to take this moral stand against Russia. But Infantino and Seferin didn't want to do that at that point. They only did this under the pressure of European governments, European sanctions, and European football federations that had a moral backbone for 5 minutes to do that. And the double standard, actually, is those same European federations, some who, by the way, show solid, say this in solidarity with Palestine, Ireland, Spain, Italy, countries like that who basically abandoned Palestine here in this sense, right? Their public, their fans were threatening to boycott football, something that people do not do all the time. It is the global game. It is the number one sport in the world. Yet they were willing to do that for Russia, and they haven't done an ounce of that. And these are also, in Spain's case, a lot of good talk. A prime minister who says a lot of good things on TV. But if he boycotted football, think about that. They are the number one nation in the world with the best player in the world. Most people going to the World Cup want to see them, Argentina, Brazil. If they said they would boycott football tomorrow, FIFA would suspend Israel. If they said they'd boycott football tomorrow, they'd be out of the Champions League and out of UEFA overnight. They make so much money for UEFA. Now, answering the second point about that, geopolitics, sport has always been at the pinnacle of changing the world in geopolitics. Think about this, right? After World War II, the first things we not just hold Germany accountable in Nuremberg and other war crime tribunals, but we banned them from international sport for 6 years. Nazi Germany and Germany, West and East, were banned for 6 years until the 1954 World Cup. Closer to home in Europe, Yugoslavia, during the Balkan War, was suspended from football and international competition. A war, by the way, that the UEFA president was personally involved in. He volunteered for the Slovenian army and witnessed atrocities, witnessed massacres of Bosnians, and has spoken about that repeatedly, about how culture had an impact. So the hypocrisy is really there, because they're trying to remove football and other sport from geopolitics and politics, because it's become such a big business. Historically, sport has been at the forefront of isolating nations, committing war crimes, and punishing them and holding them accountable when they've committed crimes against humanity, like genocide, like apartheid, and the most popular, the biggest example is apartheid South Africa, where it isolated a nation and eventually brought it down.
Well, Mr. Prashar, I do, if you could please briefly answer your own question. You were saying how the human rights experts and people have been demanding and urging the boycotting of the Israeli football. Specifically, we have the 2026 Football World Cup coming up. Do you think that will happen? Why yes or no? Why?
Well, so look, as you guys know, as you've covered, we launched a campaign with Richard Falk, Craig McIver, other former UN High Commissioners, called Game Over Israel. And we never focused on FIFA. We have no intention of trying to get them thrown out of FIFA. The reality is, if you want to end Israeli football, you need to get them thrown out of UEFA. And I'll tell you why. Fundamentally, like Leila said, like you have introed, there's no way FIFA are going to kick Israel out of football. Fundamentally, because they're aligned with U.S. foreign policy, and Gianni Infantino is so bent that everybody knows it at this point, right? He was actually Israel's pick for the job. UEFA, on the other hand, is where Israel plays 90% of its football. They play in the Champions League, the Europa League, the Conference League. Israel's federation is housed within UEFA, which is ironic given they're a Middle East nation. But also, their international competitions, the Nations League, the European Championships, that is where they make all their money. And here's the kicker. They also get a subsidy from UEFA to keep the league running. Because unlike the Premier League and La Liga, and this is not just a knock on the Israeli league. Like, no one watches Hungarian football internationally. No one watches Polish football. They get a subsidy from the big leagues who survive. And what we're trying to do with Game Over Israel, and what we think we will achieve in January, is UEFA actually suspending Israel, because we have run this campaign since September, and it's clear that Israel has no intention of following this fake peace plan that Donald Trump has. But also, legally, we are taking them to court in Switzerland, where they're in breach of international law, because they've actually encroached on Asian football territory by having occupied teams in the occupied territory participating in the Israeli Football League. Secondly, and this is good, unfortunately, it always comes down to money. UEFA only get a tax exemption in Switzerland if they continue to promote peace. Now, figure that. You get a tax exemption if you promote peace. Now, while Israel participates under the UEFA banner and has teams in the occupied territory, they're in breach of their own tax exemption. And that is what we're going after.
Very interesting. Getting a tax when you promote peace, protesting at peace, and you get detained and arrested. There's so many things going on in this world. It's become insane. Ms. Hatoum, let's go ahead and take it a bit step further. I mean, the Palestinian footballers on the ground, they have been killed. Their stadiums have been damaged. Traveling just for matches has been made basically impossible. At what point can FIFA's inaction actually become complicity in this destruction and genocide?
oh, it has been complicit since long time ago. I mean, remember, like, it, the whole attack against Palestinian footballers didn't start 2 years ago with this war, October 7, 2023, until today. It started way before, when the Israeli snipers were targeting the knees of Palestinian footballers on the ground, be it in Gaza or the West Bank. They were targeting future footballers when they were shooting little children in their knees as well. So at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, the Israeli occupation was practicing the act of taking out future football players and current football players at that time through sniping their knees. And FIFA didn't do anything. There were lots of complaints that were lodged, even by the PA itself. And PA is like, it lacks action at most of the time. And the FIFA and UEFA and anybody else, they didn't move. And I disagree with our colleague over here when it comes to possible action being taken in January. I don't see the Spaniards moving. The Spaniards actually promised to protect the flotilla at one point or another, and they actually didn't send their own navy to protect the flotilla. The Spaniards could have easily lodged a complaint to UEFA, and the La Liga is one of the biggest in UEFA, in Europe's basically federation for football, and they haven't done anything. The Italians, they're not going to do anything, and the Italian league is very big. When it comes to the French league is very big. They're not going to do any action against the Israelis. So who's left? The Irish are going to move anything? The Germans? I highly doubt that the Germans are going to take action. The Nazi Germany today basically supports the Zionist Israeli entity. That's why I call them the Zionazis and the Nazi Zionists. So at the end of the day, I highly doubt that there will be any action on a collective level from UEFA, but possibly from smaller countries within Europe. They could basically threaten and basically boycott playing games with the Israelis. I do bet that UEFA is going to actually implement fines on them and call them anti-Semitic itself.
Well, on that, we have a few more minutes left. I would like to go ahead and cross back over to Mr. Prashar. Mr. Prashar, I mean, ultimately, who is FIFA for? Is it for the global majority of players and fans who actually gather from around the world, no matter your nationality, no matter your culture, no matter your religion, just to sit, to enjoy a good match? Or has it actually become for the politicians, for the corporations it now so openly serves?
Firstly, I want to say I agree with Leila. I think football could have done something like they did for Russia. So I don't disagree. Spain, Italy, no, they're not going to do what they did against Russia. But What I want to say is that, unfortunately, because nobody's going to do anything, it is down to football fans, and it is down to the legal action and other things other people are taking behind the scenes right now to push UEFA over the edge. But FIFA's gone from the public. The game is gone. The game doesn't belong to the people anymore. Unfortunately, look, there is ways that the public can reclaim the game, right, and show their power, right? You're already seeing across Europe people protesting, demonstrating, showing tifos and banners in behalf of Palestine, everywhere from Istanbul to Paris to even in Germany, frankly, and they've been cracked down upon, but they still keep going. But the game, FIFA does, as an institution, is lost to the public at this point. It hasn't been that way since, I would go as far back as the 94 World Cup. The irony of that, the last time the Americans held the World Cup, was the beginning of the corporate decline of FIFA as an institution. After that, it became, you know, the home of politicians and Coca-Cola. And it will continue to go down that path unless the fans, frankly, reclaim the game and take this monstrosity back. But we see no willpower in people giving up the one, what I call their one escape from their normal life. That's the sad truth about it, especially for Westerners. They go to this game to vent. They go to this game to, like, escape from life sometimes, right? You think about conditions that people live in. I mean, you mentioned it. You know, even in the UK, you know, the quality of life right now is not great. People go to a Liverpool game to escape that. Do you see them giving it up for a week or 2 weeks to change and can take back some power in football? No, FIFA is going to continue down the Americanization of this sport, similar to the NFL, similar to basketball, where it's become less about the fans, their experience, their relationship with the pitch and the game. And more about how much money they can rake in. Just look at the ticket prices. Some basic World Cup final ticket prices are $7,000. And there's no guarantee that even if you pay that, you won't be arrested, detained, and deported by ICE if you go to the United States.
Well, and on that point, it seems I'm afraid we have run out of time. I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining us during this very interesting topic that definitely needs to be talked about more often. First of all, from New York, Mr. Ashish Prashar, political analyst and former West Asia Peace Envoy Advisor. And, of course, as always, from Beirut, Ms. Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief of MENA Uncensored. A pleasure to have you both. Until next time, goodbye.
Each other, that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Tomorrow will be free.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.